Well, you know, I have a basic setup. It was one back, one body, and one 80mm lens, which is standard focus, standard focal length. And I got it at a street fair from somebody that I knew, and it was very clean. It was almost like new, and back then they cost more than they do now.
Okay, well, every so often someone picks up a prize. You know, everyone has a fish story.
Well, I guess the story is really about the experiences I had with that camera. Some people, you know, they have memories of work, maybe magazine work or some other kind of work. For me, it was about just being out in the streets photographing. And how to say portraits of women was my subject for the thesis.
Okay, that's a popular one.
It is what it is. It is what it is. But, you know, from there it was like, you know, Hasselblad and a flash anywhere.
Okay, and especially with Hasselblads, as we mentioned before, unless you want to really blow them up, you could use relatively sensitive film, and the grain will be less obvious with a 2.5-inch square film stock as opposed to 35mm.
QSL, yeah, I used the Portra 400. And I pushed it to 800 and got really good results.
Yeah, you can get away with things more. One of my first cameras, my father, may rest in peace, he had a twin lens reflex that was a 2.5-inch film cartridge in it. And when I was very little and I couldn't afford an enlarger, it was a joy. Because you can get away with just contact printing a 2.5-inch film. You know, it looks like wallet pictures. So later on, I got an enlarger, and I could enlarge things much bigger than that. But it was loads of fun playing with that twin lens reflex.
Do you know about the Yashicomat 124G?
Not specifically. I remember Yashica. I think one of my earliest small rangefinder cameras was the Yashica.
The Yashicomat 124G twin lens reflex. The person who invented it, I don't know if he's still alive, but he has a shop in Marietta, Georgia, where he repairs them. They don't produce them anymore. But it's a great camera. You know, it's a great camera because it's light and small. You can put it in a bag really easy, and it takes really, really excellent photographs.
Oh, okay. I'm unfamiliar with it. I probably have seen them in magazines. I used to get a lot of photographic magazines. My father's old twin lens reflex was the only twin lens I used. I went on from there. I bought inexpensive rangefinders and then single lens reflexes, and my latest is a mirrorless digital camera, which I'm pleased at.
Well, one of the great things about Yashicomat 124G is you can get it really cheap. They're really inexpensive cameras. I don't know if even the lenses are glass, you know. And I used to shoot a Ilford HP5 black and white, and so many experiences with that camera.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's not the the powerfulness of the design. It's a tool. Some people could do great things with simple tools, and other people waste their time with expensive tools. So, yeah, that's the nature of things. And ultimately, it comes down to your life experiences with these tools. You know, what you do, where you do it, and how you do it.
Well, Roy, I have to say, I don't take pictures. I don't make art for anybody except me. So I do it to please me, and it's an act of self-indulgence. If somebody else likes it, that's great, you know, but not a requirement.
No, I agree with you, David. You know, I've mentioned before, I kind of run this TechNet the way I like to listen to TechNet. So, yeah, I feel the same way.
Well, I'm glad we can agree on this. And I don't want to take away too much time from the other people on the TechNet. So I say thank you very much and have a fantastic night.
Thank you very much, David. This is AC2GS. Wesley, you have a question tonight?
Yeah, I had a comment last week about the fuses, and there was some kind of protest when I mentioned about the inductance of that helical coil that is in some of the fuses and its inductance. So the responding person says, I'm withdrawing my question. And I said, well, I have a material about it. So there is a company, Gold Shomut, from Newburyport, Massachusetts. They are specializing in inductance fuses in high-frequency power electronic circuits. So they're talking about the frequency from 2 kHz to 20 kHz when the switching DIDT is very high. So therefore, the circuit inductance must be kept low to minimize transient voltages. And that was what I was trying to say, but I was actually not listening to. And they also have a capacitive fuses, if I may use the word capacitor. But before we go to that, so when we're dealing with high frequency and we have that spiral helical part of the fuse, at the high frequency it reacts like a coil. And it is not applicable for high frequency applications. As far as like capacitance. There is a number of fuses that is produced by a company named Eaton, E-A-T-O-N. And some of them are used for protection of capacitor banks where the medium energy interrupting ability is required. But the function of the fuse tube is to confine the arc and produce arc quenching gases, which are expelled from the end of the tube. And so the voltage stress across the tube is eliminated by the gap between the end of the fuse and the tube and the capacitor terminal. So there is no possibility of tracking and eventual flashover even after the exposure to the weather and contamination. Those are actually not in electronic circuits. They are in much bigger commercial applications. Back to you.
Okay, Wesley, I understand. See, the problem is that the way you presented it last week confused myself and other people. Because, truth be said, none of us have ever used high-frequency RF fuses, and I'm not quite sure if you've ever used a high-frequency RF fuse. And so, and the way that you presented it did not really hit anyone that this was something new. It sounded like you were talking about a fuse that happened to be coiled. And as we talked last week, there are regular AC 60-cycle fuses. Usually slow fuses that have coil structures in them. So you have to understand the basis of most people listening to you kind of got completely lost by your subject. They did not really, I didn't at least, get a feel that you were talking about a somewhat esoteric high-frequency fuse, because I don't have any experience with it. And again, a lot of people listening to you didn't have any experience with it. So I think that was the problem.
Well, I have a problem with that, too. Because frequency is 2 kHz to 20 kHz is used in inverters. So to protect IGBT inverters against the effects of short circuit faults, those fuses have a special fuse being used. And those are IGBTs are everywhere right now. So if we're talking about the deposit, not esoteric, but a typical application, there is a typical application. So, and I was mentioning that it's a high-frequency application. Unless that phrase of high-frequency came later after the protest and to FCM.
ACTPL, well after the protest.
Go ahead.
No, Jeff was pointing out, yes, you made a point of it after everyone was deeply confused. I really was unable to extract the understanding that you were talking about a particular type of high-frequency fuse. The way it sounded to me, it was a fuse, it was a coiled fuse, and the importance of...
So all 10 were working good. The Orion spacecraft itself, which consists of the European Space Agency's service module, which gives the spacecraft propulsion, gives it 60 kilowatts of power from the solar panels, which actually are producing more than they expected. That service module will eventually hold a water and for the crew, when there is a crew there about a year and a half from now, they'll put a crew on board one of these Orion spacecraft. And the Orion spacecraft itself, built by Lockheed, is also they said 100%. So when it went around the moon after what, 3.5-4 days after launch, successfully used its 6,000-pound service module thruster that was developed by the European Space Agency to put it into a distant retrograde orbit, which it went into for about four days, and then had to do one more burn, and then stayed in that orbit for six more days. And now it's already, time is all going by, it's already done a burn to start its way coming back, and we'll do another burn tomorrow, actually, to really set itself up for a very low pass of the moon. We'll do one sweep around the moon and then start heading back to Earth. As it gets near Earth, we'll be going 25,000 miles an hour. Right now it's around a little over 2,000 miles per hour going around the moon. But it starts to accelerate due to the gravity well created by Earth, and it'll eventually separate from the service module. So all you have left is the Orion spacecraft. The service module will eventually burn up in the atmosphere. The Orion spacecraft itself will do a 180. It has little thrusters on board, little reaction control thrusters to turn itself around and orient itself with the heat shield coming in first. And that'll, that heat shield, which is like 15 feet in diameter, will start to heat up and get up to maybe 1,000 degrees. That's the biggest test that NASA wants to know about. Make sure this heat shield survives this 25,000-mile speed, usually at 17,000 miles an hour from Earth orbit. When you're coming back from the moon or Mars, you're looking at 25,000 miles an hour. So the shield has to be able to survive that. once it gets through the atmosphere, you're going to have parachutes, a series of parachutes opening up. You have little drogue parachutes that come out. They pull out the bigger parachutes, and there's a series of them. There's 11 parachutes that have to successfully deploy, slowing it down to you know, maybe 12 miles an hour before it actually hits the water. There'll be a ship waiting for it, and they'll scoop it up and bring it home. And then they'll check everything out. On board, they have tons of data that they have to get off that craft. For the whole flight, they've been sending data back, you know, with RF, but there's a lot more that they won't be able to bring back unless the craft itself comes back. The hard drives are going to be loaded with data. So once they get that back, they'll have, you know, really outrageous pictures and information back. For instance, they don't know anything about the mannequins that they had on board, which had I think, I don't know, 1,000 sensors or something on inside the mannequin for heat, humidity, the gravity, you know, how many G's this thing went through, all through the flight. All that information will be at hand after they get back out of the Pacific Ocean. So that's the story, and, you know, I'll give a full report on Artemis again next week during the net, because it'll be a couple of hours after they successfully get the thing back. Hopefully you get a crew on there within, they say, 2024. They'll have a crew on board, crew of four, that will go to the moon, orbit the moon, but it's a completely different orbit. The distant retrograde orbit that was used this time will probably never be used again in our lifetime. Like this one, because, you know, it went, like, past the moon, around 50,000 miles away from the moon, and it was actually doing a slow orbit around the moon. It would have taken a couple of weeks to actually make one orbit, so it actually just did one arc. But, you know, as far as the deep space network sees from Earth, when they're looking at, you know, looking at that spacecraft, it's pretty much in one spot. And they were able to do countless tests on Orion, you know, all the thrusters, you know, they have dozens of thrusters of different types, different sizes. All tested, all the communication equipment, navigation equipment, star trackers, able to check out everything while it was at that distant retrograde orbit. So, the only reason they use that orbit is because years ago, a couple of administrations ago, seemed like they couldn't decide whether we should go back to the moon or Mars. So they planned on, at that time, docking with an asteroid, and they were going to have, you know, an Orion type of spacecraft attached to an asteroid, and they were going to do an EVA, take parts of the asteroid out, and they were going to bring it back to Earth. They called ARM, that was Asteroid Redirect Mission. What they were going to do is they were going to take another spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, and they were going to go out to where the asteroids are, somewhere between Mars and Jupiter. Or, you know, maybe they were going to pick up a near-Earth asteroid. Anyway, they were going to take one of these things, it was going to be about 300 feet in diameter, and they were going to bring it back, and they were going to put it into this distant retrograde orbit, and, you know, 50,000 miles away from the moon, and it was going to go around and around. It would take, like, you know, like I said, a couple of weeks to make one orbit. A crew would have gone out there and attached it to the asteroid and did an EVA and brought stuff back. And of course, it was all abandoned. But what happened is they learned a lot, and about the distant retrograde orbit. So they thought, well, that would be great for this mission, this 25, 26-day mission, which is unmanned. When this thing is crewed, say a year and a half from now, it's not going to be a 26-day mission. It's really, Orion is really designed for people no more than 21 days. It'll probably be an 8 or 9 day mission. So that's the story with that. And then if that goes well, the following year, they plan on sending a crew to actually land on the moon. Another Orion mission, Artemis 3. And that's a planned lunar landing mission. I'm a little concerned about that, the way they get from the moon, from the moon's orbit to the moon itself, is using they plan on using a SpaceX spacecraft that's not even built yet that they're testing now in Texas. As far as I'm concerned, not even ready to do this. He's supposed to be testing the Starship vehicle. He's supposed to have it in orbit around Earth. He's supposed to be able to refuel around Earth. He's supposed to send one of these things, a different version of it, out to the moon, sit there and wait for the Artemis crew to show up in 2025. I just don't see it happening. But, the way it's going at this rate, I don't know. Elon is distracted or whatever. I'm glad NASA has chosen the redundancy program when it comes to this. Originally, they just gave one contract out to SpaceX. They're going to do the human landing system and nobody else. Well, 6 months or so went by. And they finally came to the realization, well, let's look at those other two companies that were going to do that as well. So this way you'll have redundancy. They're supposed to pick one of them. I hope they pick both. One is Blue Origin and the other one is Dynetics. We'll see. Any questions or comments for the SpaceNet report? This is WS2X.
Excuse me. How you doing?
Hi, Frank. I left enough time for you that time. Finally. Back to you.
Yeah, okay. Hopefully I'm done sneezing. First of all, I did watch Goodnight Oppie on Prime Friday night. My wife was bored and went downstairs, but I enjoyed it. And I told her she would have gotten a kick out of the story about the one of the young woman engineers who was in launch control as a 16-year-old girl with her class watching the launch, and eventually got through college and grad school and got to work on the project that was running so long. So I thought that was interesting. They had a couple of seconds of footage of her watching the launch jumping up and down as a teenager. I thought that was pretty cool, but it was an interesting story. It's interesting how they kind of anthropomorphized the thing and played it wake-up songs, etc. I found that kind of amusing. Anyway, like you said, well done documentary, not your average documentary. Maybe you're going to get to it. Is there a launch date? I understand there is a proposed launch date for the so-called BFR, what I think they're calling the Super Heavy now. Some of the pundits seem to think it's really in March, but I think the official one is late December. Go ahead.
I heard possibly the end of December, but I'm not seeing that from what I read. I'm going to go with you know, either next month or February at the earliest. I don't, you know, I know he's running tests. He hasn't done a full test on all 33 engines on the Super Heavy launch vehicle yet. He's got to be able to do that with the Starship itself on top. He's got to, you know, they call that a wet rehearsal. Got to, you know, I mean, he's done, I think the last test was 11 engines. He ran them for 20 seconds or so, which is pretty good, but he's got to do them all at once. The last time he did them all at once, which was, I don't know, 6 months or so ago, maybe longer, I'm losing track of time, he had that fire and explosion caused some damage, set him back a little bit. I mean, they didn't wipe everything out, but it caused some damage. He's got to get over that hurdle. You know, I hope they do it, but I'm not sure if they will. And, yeah, good night, Appy. Some of the girls that were there, they were chosen. They were picked to be at that, be at JPL when they did landing. And yeah, sure enough, she's now involved with the program. That was very well done. Then Jennifer Torino, I forgot, she was in charge of Spirit. When that thing died, of course, this is a very dramatic show, if you like drama. It was very well done. Let me drop it. And now she's another project manager for something else now with NASA. I think they transferred over to Goddard. Bob Manning wrote a book about Curiosity. If you like these type of stories, you might want to read that book. The development of Curiosity, now riding around on Mars, and eventually years later, of course, a year and a half ago, we had Perseverance also land on Mars. They're very similar, but of course, one is like 10 years more advanced than the other. But they're both nuclear powered, and they're both right now they're both riding around on Mars. Anyway, Bob Manning, you saw the movie, so the guy at the very end, you saw him a couple times during the movie, but at the very end, he was sitting home during a launch of the rocket, and he was you want, that's Rob Manning, heavily involved, instrumental in developing all this. So it's written by him and another guy, and the name of the book is it's actually Mars Rover Curiosity, and it's an account of Curiosity, chief engineer Bob Manning. But that's very well done. Yeah, they really do details. Of course, the movie is made for the general public, so this book has got a lot of details. You know, the movie, you know, they showed them playing songs. Yeah, they played all the songs in the control. You would hear them all loud, and you know, sound bar on it. Sounds great. And then they switch. They'll show a scene of Opportunity on Mars, and they showed it, you know, all of a sudden the sound is very low, you know, and like they had a speaker on Opportunity or Spirit, you know, like they were here. Of course, they did not hear that transmission, but that's the way they made it look in the movie, things like that. But, you know, I would say it was, definitely a family could view. And even so, it looks like the ending, that probe's not going to last forever. I knew what they were going to do. They were going to show another launch curiosity and eventually they didn't show perseverance. Or did they? Wait a minute. Now I forgot. Anyway, they showed one of those two at the very end. Any other comments? Frank?
It was good. And, Fraser Kane, I think his name is from Universe Today, is, he thinks the Super Heavy will go in March. And he pinpointed the date for the Artemis 1 launch within a couple of weeks when he predicted that one back in August. So I suspect he's going to be right on that. And, yeah, I'd like to see Elon concentrate on building his rockets rather than fooling around with Twitter. But, that's neither here nor there. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, he gets bored with things. I think he does anyway. He goes from one thing to the other, you know. But at least he's got a lot of money poured into the SpaceX and the engineers and people that work there are kind of hoping that he stays with Twitter. Just, like, leave us alone, you know, we'll get the job done. That's what it sounds like to me. I hope that's the way it goes.
Yeah, well, we all of us who have worked in large organizations know the experience who have bosses, of bosses meddling in our work and seemingly not letting us get it done, and not being close enough to the work themselves to make useful suggestions. But I can certainly empathize with that, and I'm sure a lot of people on frequency can too. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I agree. You can't do one without the other. You need the business people involved, and of course you got the workers, the engineers, and it's a combination of the two. But when the owners get overpowering, now that changes things. Now Musk is supposed to be, very knowledgeable of all this stuff, and I'm sure he is. But I offer one, I see getting a lot of suggestions from the field. You don't really get that many interviews from people that are presently working for him. It's not like NASA. I like little NASA launches. Look at the details you get from the Artemis launch and all the stuff that's involved with the spacewalk last week. You had two guys out there doing hooking up solar panels, and they have every minute of it is displayed. On TV and news conferences. You had Frank Rubio out there. He was one of the guys that just went up there on a SpaceX mission. Josh Cassada hooking up this solar panel, which, by the time they're done, with all these solar panels that they're adding, they're going to get from 160 kilowatt system to 215 kilowatt system. To see Cassada at the end of the robot arm. By the way, he's a ham. KI5CRH. And Frank Ruby, I don't see a qualify for him. But you know, to see these guys do that work for almost 8 hours out there doing what they had to do was really incredible. I'm out of chance. I click on that to TV to watch that. And then, you know, you have a bunch of people up there. There's five of them inside the spacecraft while these two guys are on the outside. You have seven people on one space station. You have three other guys on a Chinese space station. And you have an Artemis mission going around the moon, coming back. A tremendous amount of information. But yet I can't find out when Musk, Starship rocket is going to go up. Well, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with his other rocket? The other Falcon drop it. Supposed to go up, I think last Wednesday. We had a Falcon 9 poised to launch that thing. It's by, you know, a company named iSpace from Japan built a lander that is supposed to actually land on the moon. It's supposed to be launched by SpaceX. And on his lander, it's a good-sized lander. He's got two rovers built by Japan, but the rovers are built by UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Two little tiny rovers, very small rovers, are going to ride around on the moon. And they also made an arrangement with NASA. NASA is also sending with this lander. Before that lands, they're going to put a satellite into orbit called Flashlight, which is supposed to look for ice, which would eventually, of course, be water on the moon. Got a laser beam on board, ultraviolet. Correction, infrared. Laser is just going to look for ice. But all these, you know, this lander, the two rovers, and there's one orbiter that's going to go to the moon. It's supposed to go last Wednesday, and then the day after that. And SpaceX kept saying, well, there's a problem here, problem there, but they wouldn't say what it is. But it's with their rocket. It's not with this the setup that's going to be going to the moon. And unfortunately, we don't get enough answers. If it was NASA, they would be reported down there asking questions, and more or less they not always, but almost always have answers for the reporters. Or at least they'll say, we'll get you an answer soon. Any comments or questions? Okay, nothing else heard. This is WS2N. Just mentioned the fellow, Cassidy. He had a telebridge conference with junior high school up in Nova Scotia last week as well. I guess in between the EVAs that they're doing, they make time for contacting the school. And I think it's over 1,400th contact, radio contact from the space station. But Cassiter, KI5CRH, made this telebridge, as they call it, telebridge contact. So this is all through ARIES, through amateur radio on the International Space Station Group that arranges all this. And through the telebridge deal, they have to, it's actually a telephone system from Canada, and that is linked through to an actual transmitter in Italy. They use the the station over there, IK1SLD, that does the telebridge for Italy. There's a series of different telebridges that they use, and in this case they use that one because they figure that's where the ISS was going to be at the time. So that Italy station has a pass of roughly 12 minutes, and they're able to get all the kids' questions answered. So it's a big thrill. I'm sure they won't forget it anytime soon. Any comments? WS.
Enter VHZ Mobile in Nebraska.
N2VHD, I think that's N2 Victor Hotel Delta. Anyway, this is WS2N, Paul, and we're here for the SpaceNet report on the TechNet every Sunday night. And very good. What's your name there, and what's your question from Nebraska?
Yeah, hi, Paul. Name is Ken Kilorka, November. Call sign's November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu, otherwise known as November 2, Very High Zeppelin. I also operate as November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu, stroke 0, out of South Dakota. I'm probably the most prolific Nebraska operator you'll ever know, trust me. So, name is Ken Kilorka, November. I have a story to share rather quickly. While in Germany operating as Delta Alpha 2 Kilo Whiskey and zipping down the Autobahn at about 120 miles an hour, working for the government, the United States government, early in the morning at about 3:45, 4 o'clock in the morning, I heard a station acknowledge a French station, but I didn't know who that was. So I threw my call sign out, Delta Alpha 2 Kilo Whiskey. It was the ISS flying overhead. And I made a quick contact with the ISS while shooting down the Autobahn at about 3:45 in the a.m. That's how they added some skills. Back to you.
That's great. That's a story for QST. Once in a while, they'll put a story in like that. You know, there was some guy that made the contact all by himself with the... He had a portable setup, antenna in the backyard. He was holding on, you know, with his hand, you know, and trying to track the thing across the sky. But that was a pretty good story as well. But yeah, you never know. They do that. You're driving 110 miles an hour. I don't know. Do you remember the astronaut that was up there at the time?
No, I had no idea even what was going on. I was just driving along, listening to my tunes, and listening. I had the radio scanning, and it stopped. And I heard a guy acknowledge a French station. I said, "That's really odd. I'm not really anywhere near France. I was in Germany, and I was on VHF." So I just threw out my call sign, Delta Alpha Kilo Whiskey, and it was the ISS. And he came right back to me. And then he went on to I believe it was another station, maybe another country. But you get in and go across Europe, you know. But, you know, I was paying attention to what was in my headlights, you know. But no, I didn't even log it or anything. I thought it was pretty cool. I was actually going to my job at like 5 in the morning. No, I had no idea who the astronaut was. Back to you.
Yeah, well, you were in Europe, so they're using radio that's in the Russian module, the functioning cargo block, they call it the Zarya module. That's where their radio is located. And then the other radio is located in the Columbia module near the front of the space station. And actually, but nowadays they're both the same radios. They're both Kenwood radios, and they can put out just 25 watts, I think they're using now. But going back, don't know how many years ago it was. My guess, it was one of the European stations. On the space station, you have when you make contact with the United States, they use NA1SS for the United States. If they're using European Space Agency, any one of those, they're usually using the Belgian. There's a Belgian call that they use, and then if it's a Russian transmission, they also transmit the Zarya block. RS1. I have to go with it, but RA1SS, I think it is. But anyway, that's the there's three different call letters that the space station uses. And my the ZAP block for that transmission, which is really pretty cool. And you had different, about 8 years ago, you would be Tom Peake.
This is probably about 06, 05, 06, 07 maybe. I made the contact. Yeah, interesting. I got into your net because of a net also. I got into that today on 10 meters from here. That was exciting, you know. On a 28.380, I think it was. I checked into you guys this morning. It was quite exciting. But okay, I'll drop it. I'm gonna go back, focus on my driving. I'm out here heading down the highway on our little autobahn out here in Nebraska. I'm headed back up to South Dakota. I'm traveling down the highway here by 85 miles an hour. It's not quite as exciting as the German autobahn though. Okay, I'll say 7-3 for now. Back to net control. This is N2 VHC Mobile.
Okay, nice working with Ken. And I wonder if that was a 10 meter net with AC2GS, Dr. Roy. That sounds like that. Roy, did you make contact with Nebraska this morning?
Yes, indeed, Paul. I was at my regular every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. I wasn't exactly on 28.380 today because someplace in Europe was trying to get contacts on that frequency. So I moved, nudged down to about 28.383. And towards the end of the 10-meter net, Ken checked in, which I was very happy to hear. It's the first time I've actually made contact with Ken direct via RF instead of the Internet.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's great. Source off Nebraska for your 10 meters. And if you haven't gotten it already.
Time.
Very good. I'm looking at the time. I don't really have that much more traffic, so I'm going to pass it over to you, Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night for the Club Info Net on this these frequencies, except at 8:30, not 8 o'clock. And that's always followed by George and Katie to FIU for the Flop and Chop. That's always followed by this line. I'll see you, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, very good. By the way, Ken is a traveling man, so I actually have him logged in as South Dakota because that's where he was this morning. I guess this evening he's in Nebraska. Anyway, thanks, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net, and thanks for all that you do for the club. We all do appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Hope you had a fun time. Hope you learned a few things. Hope you taught a few things. And I hope you'll come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we're going to try and do it all over again. As Dick would often end his technical nets, be kind to each other. That's always good advice, but especially now. We live in dangerous times, so be kind to each other. And my favorite quote from Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So be open to new ideas. Anyway, have a great week. Have loads of fun, but do come back next Sunday night because I need you for the next one. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS. Roy here, formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net, and I am clear.